You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me, once again, a friend of mine, David Jensen. David is a real good friend that I've learned to know over the last quite a few years, actually. And, well, we share ideas of free markets and liberty. I guess we have that in common for sure. He is a professional engineer, and he's worked in the past as an aeronautical engineer. He is also has an MBA, a law degree, a very well-educated person. But the most important thing about David is that he's a critical thinker who, I would say, unlike many other engineers, he's really interested in areas outside of engineering, and he looks critically using the same skill set to look at politics and economics and things that are going on in the real world, uses those same gifts that he has that he would be applicable to science, also uses them to think critically about what's actually taking place in the world. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to have him here today to talk about a very important subject, and that is, could the petro-yuan overtake the petro-dollar? Thanks for joining me today, David.
My pleasure, Jay. It's good to be back.
Always good to have you. We don't have you often enough. We have 1 hour a week to talk to people. That's the constraint. But David, just perhaps to set the table for our listeners, people that I think our very first guest that we had on the show back almost 10 years ago was G. Edward Griffin, who talked to us about the creature from Jekyll Island, the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913. Can you talk to us a little bit about what the Fed did, I mean, how it altered the U.S. monetary system and what the excuse for its creation was?
Yeah, well, the Fed was created ostensibly to avert bank panics. And what they did, they argued that they needed you've heard the old joke that the Federal Reserve is not federal and it has no reserves.
Yeah.
And what they did was because they wanted to get away from a gold or a sound money system to a fiat printed money system, they replaced the notes quite rapidly. Actually, they started to collect the gold and silver that were in circulation, and they started to replace them with these Federal Reserve notes. And what the notes did was that it allowed them to create what they called at the time an elastic monetary system. And what it allowed them to do then was to print money, which you can't do. You can't print gold when you have a sound money system. And it was said to help prevent panics. But what it really was it did two things. Is one, it was a form of gambling insurance for the financial industry. So it allowed them to gamble and to know that with fractional reserve holdings that they could run bubbles and run loose practices, and they would always have the Federal Reserve there just to back them up, as we most recently saw, of course, with the great financial crisis in 2008. And the other thing it did ultimately was allowed the Federal Reserve to control the nation's money supply, and you can throttle the economy, and I guess in both using the term throttle for both its meanings. They could run loose money, expand the economy, accelerate speculation, as we've seen now in spades over the last several decades, and then they could cut it back and ultimately squeeze the economy and cause the bubbles to collapse. Mm-hmm. As well. So I mean, and of course, as Ron Paul always likes to talk about, it allowed deficit spending by governments because they can just print away the debt that is accumulated when they have large expenditure programs.
Yeah, they can basically front run, because if they know what's coming and they're involved, the Fed is involved and its minions close to it in the banking system can really know ahead of time what's happening and actually take positions for a down market or an up market, depending on whichever way it's orchestrated, right?
That's right.
So Roosevelt really came down hard on anybody that wanted to own honest money, stable money, gold. It wasn't just a suggestion. It was a law that was punishable by, I think, $10,000 and 10 years in prison if you refused to turn in your gold. And then Roosevelt afterwards, after he, I guess he paid people, what, $28 and some cents per ounce, but then immediately afterwards increased it to $35, right?
That's right. There was a massive amount of debt that had been built up during the 1920s, and in 1928 and 1929, that the Federal Reserve cut back on the availability of money and started to raise interest rates and ultimately cut back on the liquidity in the economy. And the economy collapsed, and the debt as a portion of GDP increased to a little over 250% at the time. Mm-hmm. And that had a very onerous effect on the economy. So they wanted to inflate money supply to inflate away the level of that debt. And they used that as an opportunity to take the sound money out of the hands of citizens and ultimately concentrate the control of the economy in the privately held Federal Reserve system.
Right. So now we have a few people that are controlling, have enormous amounts of power and control. But up until 1971, at least we had an international standard, gold standard. Can you talk about the reasons given by President Nixon for temporarily, quote unquote, suspending convertibility of gold internationally?
Yeah, it's quite funny. I mean, they had a gold problem, but they had raging inflation. They had been printing money for the Vietnam War, plus Lyndon Johnson's social policies that were running massive deficits, the guns and butter policy. And so they said that they had to suspend convertibility of gold to fight inflation, which is really quite humorous, because what gold does is it prevents you from running loose monetary policy if you have a gold standard. And the gold standard, by the way, is really a paper money system. I'm not for it, but it's a promise not to print more paper than the gold that you have, but it's always violated. But in essence, he wasn't suspending the gold convertibility to fight inflation. He was doing the opposite. They needed to inflate away the debt, and they didn't want the foreign holders of U.S. dollars, who since 1933 could still turn those in, foreign governments could still turn in their USD holdings and get gold. And they had multiples the amount of notes outstanding versus the gold that they held to settle them. So they suspended that temporarily, but I think full knowing that you've got many times the amount of notes outstanding versus the amount of gold that you hold to secure those notes. You're not going back onto that standard again. But it was anything but fighting inflation. It was to really allow forward-looking future inflationary monetary policy.
And, of course, we know now how many decades later it was anything but temporary. Give us an idea. How was the dollar able to retain its value, its hegemony globally, in spite of the fact that it has nothing underneath it? There's no intrinsic value to the dollar. There's no reason. In fact, the U.S. has printed trillions of dollars to expand its empire, to do all kinds of things, and yet the dollar is to this day still respected. It's still very much the world's reserve currency, the number one reserve currency. How has the U.S. been able to retain that privilege?
Well, the principal way was through the petrodollar system. Prior to the early 70s, many of the oil producers would only accept gold in return for their oil. They wanted something with intrinsic value in return for something of intrinsic value. Mm-hmm. And Henry Kissinger negotiated a deal with OPEC whereby OPEC would only price oil in dollars, and that, of course, creates a demand for dollars if you're going to buy oil. So it allowed the U.S. to export its currency, if you want to call it that, to run loose monetary policy because the global economy was continually expanding and there continually be a demand for more and more dollars. So it really allowed the backing of the dollar with oil, if you want to put it in those terms, as opposed to having it refundable for gold on demand. What it did was allow you to use those notes to secure oil purchases, and that was really what bound America in a terrible way to the Middle East. It made them dependent to protect the petro currency status. It made them militarily have to focus on the Middle East to make sure that they retained that right.
Well, so there were some guarantees, I guess, also to the to the royal family in Saudi Arabia, right? Some military guarantees as well, perhaps?
Yeah, there's a whole series of agreements between. I mean, if you look at the history of the Saudi family, it's not one that, from a democratic standpoint, that you would want to negotiate with as a democratic nation state. If you look back, we see the UK ambassador there when he retired from his post there. One of his letters has been posted online by one of the UK newspapers for the late 70s, and he made note in there that the royal family was skimming 20% of the oil revenues for their own personal holding. And so that right away there, if you act as a guarantor for a family like that, it puts you on the wrong side of democracy if that's something that you believe in.
Yeah, and when you think about it, oil is so important because, you know, most nations have to import oil to a great extent, I guess. And there are some very large producers. Saudi Arabia was big. Now Russia is very large. And so most countries had then to go out and get dollars. So it really provided a constant demand and a bid for the dollar, I guess, really held the dollar up for many years, right? That's in essence why the dollar has been able to retain its value in spite of the fact that it has no intrinsic value.
Yeah, it becomes held as a reserve currency also because of the value that you can secure energy with it. Mm-hmm. And that creates, with a growing global economy, it grows a continual demand for more and more dollars as energy and oil consumption goes up. So it's a very valuable franchise to have. But it creates a whole series of problems in terms of trying to defend that franchise and the deficits you have to run to try to do that.
Yeah. Well, it certainly it enabled. I mean, one guest I've had on this show when I was critical of the petrodollar said, yes, Jay, but it allowed the United States to expand its empire, to spend on, you know, as you were saying, the Vietnam War was one of the reasons that we left the gold standard, the international gold standard. We wouldn't be able to print money. Not every country could get away with doing that. The United States, being a superpower as it was and a victor from World War II, I guess, allowed that to happen. But, that allowed us. So this guest was saying, well, yeah, but, you know, we could never have defeated the Soviet Union if we had stayed on a gold standard.
Well, the Soviet Union, I think it's, and this is something von Mises pointed out, was it was bound to collapse because it used central planning and there was no market pricing signal to effectively allocate resources. So the story that you had to have massive military spending to bring down the Soviet Union, I think, is a canard. When you have central planning, you have misallocation of resources, and in the end, the Austrian theory of time preference shows you that you will ultimately have more consumption than you have effective production capacity, and at some point that will overwhelm your system and it will collapse. Now, military spending can accelerate that, but I would argue that it was always a given that the Soviet Union would collapse because of its central planning nature.
All right, well, that's a topic for another day. But in the meantime, of course, there are countries that are kind of sick and tired of being told they have to accept a currency that has zero intrinsic value behind it, and which leads me to the last time I recall you being on the show back in April of 2014, when you told us about the People's Bank of China and its announcement that China would be facilitating the trading of gold and oil in yuan, allowing gold settlements for oil, thus enabling the creation of a petro-yuan to compete with the petrodollar. Can you tell our listeners where that process stands now?
Yes, certainly. China, the People's Bank of China announced that back in 2014 that they were going to start an oil contract, a yuan-based oil contract. They're they are the biggest importer of oil now as a single country globally. And as their consumption increased, they wanted to use a yuan pricing system for it. The challenge is that who wants yuan, right? What can you use it for? You can use it for, you know, cheap consumer goods, but you only have so much need for that. Mm-hmm. And so what they announced back then and has been picked up on by many sources since then is that the yuan would be directly interchangeable for gold on the Shanghai Gold Exchange International Board. And the international board is in the free trade zone there in Shanghai. And in that free trade zone, you can import and export gold from that zone. It's illegal to export gold from China, but you can export it from the free trade zone on the Shanghai Gold Exchange International Board. And so that's the way they've gotten around it, is that they're now going to price a oil contract in yuan, but it's going to be exchangeable for gold. And it's interesting, CNBC noted back in October this structure, but their most recent articles about the petro yuan negate any mention of the gold interchangeability, that it's ultimately a relight of the petro gold trade. The petro-gold trade was extinguished, of course, with the petro-dollar in the early 1970s that was arranged. And now we have a reignition of this trade. And the reason it's important is a number of things. But number one is that the dollar value of gold produced globally daily versus the dollar value of oil traded daily, there's about 20 times more oil produced in dollar terms than the dollar value of gold produced in dollar terms. So a very, very small amount of daily oil production switching over to gold settlement would create an enormous drain and an enormous stress in the global paper gold market. And you and I have talked about that a number of times, mm-hmm. Jay, but the gold market is structured so that in London, where they trade about 90% of global gold trading, they are really trading these metal or gold debt instruments and not gold itself. And that's what allows them to produce more than 220 million ounces of gold a day, which is about 2.5 times global annual mine production.
Ridiculous.
Chinese production. Yeah, they're not trading gold, and they've destroyed price discovery in the gold market, which is why so few people can make sense of gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but David, let me ask you, is this, I know Alistair MacLeod has been on the show, talks about that gold market over there in Shanghai being a hedging instrument for people that don't want to accept yuan. But and you can't take gold out of China, you said. So it would seem that, you know, exporters of oil would, you know, the countries that sell, like Saudi Arabia that sells oil to China, would have to settle for gold held in China, right? So it's kind of a hedging thing. They can't really take the gold out of China back to Saudi Arabia.
Well, they can, because you can do it through the Shanghai Gold Exchange International Board, which is in that free trade zone from which you can export gold. Now, you cannot export gold from China itself unless the Chinese government makes allowance for that. Mm-hmm. But as the law stands right now, I mean, the law is whatever they say it is on any day, but as it stands right now, it's illegal to export gold, which would mean that to be able to export gold from the free trade zone for an oil producer to take delivery of the metal, that gold would have to be sourced internationally. So it would have to be brought into the free trade zone and then exported to the country for who wants to take delivery.
What guarantee? Go ahead.
Sorry, yeah, the real challenge, I mentioned one of them was the stress on the gold market. But the second thing is that if you see, if an oil producer, and let's just use Iran, not for any good reason except for the fact that it exports both to Europe and to China. And Iran, if it can secure delivery of gold bullion in return for its valuable oil, it also exports 1 million barrels of oil a day to the Eurozone. Mm-hmm. Now, they're taking euros for that right now, but it doesn't take long to figure out that the Eurozone, a zone that does whatever it takes on a monetary policy basis, as Mr. Draghi is fond of saying, but it doesn't take long to figure out that they're running extremely inflationary monetary policy. And you're going to be sitting there, if you're an Iranian oil state dealer, to say, well, why do I want more of this paper when I can have something that's real? Mm-hmm. And so, and this is something, Jay, that's, I think that the biggest challenge is not so much for the U.S. To have to deliver gold for oil, because America, it has large exports of oil as well as imports of oil daily. And if you look on a net basis, the U.S. Net daily importation of oil is only about 3.5 million barrels. And a higher oil price, you can make up for that very quickly with fracking, very, very rapidly. The Eurozone imports a net of about 9.5 million barrels a day, and they cannot organically ramp up their oil production to meet that requirement. So the challenge there, I think, really lies, the largest challenge lies for Europe. If Iran says we would like a bullion delivery, just like China gives us, we would like a bullion delivery, Europe will have to cough that up. Now, two challenges here. Number one is it's going to end the paper game in London, which has controlled the world's gold price to date. And I think if you want to settle oil and gold, you're going to have to add a zero to the price of gold at the very least for there to be enough liquidity in the system. The Eurozone has only so much gold, and you'd have to push that price, I think, at least add a zero to it to make it a sustainable basis for the price of gold. The second issue, Jay, is that rising gold prices cause rising interest rates, and although the petrodollar hegemony, as you call it, allowed the U.S. to do a number of things over decades, it's also created a $67 trillion total debt situation in the United States. And a 1% increase in interest rates is $670 billion of additional interest payments per year. And if we look back to the 1980s, when inflation was raging in the early 1980 itself, is that they had to raise interest rates 5% above the rate of inflation to arrest the rise in price of gold and to pull people back into bonds again. So this is on a number of fronts, not just oil shortage, but also global debt market basis. It's a very, very difficult strategic period that we're facing right now. And I would advocate moving towards a more sustainable, sound money system in Europe, in the United States, and not try to fight this, because you're not going to get there militarily, and you're not going to get there trying to flog what is visible to, I think, any rational observer would look at the fiat debt money system that we have now as quite comical and totally unsustainable.
David, just one thought that comes to mind here is, what guarantees do we have that the Chinese won't create a paper market rather than to allow the gold price to rise to a level that would clear the market?
Well, the Shanghai Gold Exchange, I mean, the foundation of that market is it's the kryptonite to the Western system, is that you can't write a contract for a 1 kilo bar until 1 kilo is deposited in the vault system there. So if countries are taking delivery of their metal, which I suspect that they would, I wouldn't feel better holding gold in a vault in Shanghai as opposed to holding one in an external account. It would only make sense to me if a country could take delivery of the metal itself. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, you can't print the metal, and that's I think what prevents that, Jay, is that I believe that countries are going to start taking delivery of the metal for the delta, the yuan that they don't want to use to purchase product from the Chinese, and they would take the remainder at least in the metal form.
You know, we talk a lot of times. We've had Mr. Engdahl on this show. He talks about the new Silk Road. And there was also, on I think February 21st of this year, or of last year actually, an article in the South China Morning Post announcing that the Hong Kong Gold Exchange was coordinating a yuan gold exchange corridor from Hong Kong to Dubai, including Vietnam, Myanmar, and Singapore, and others along the Silk Road. I mean, the point I think Americans don't really focus on at all is that ultimately, your security depends on economic stability, and the Chinese and other parts of the world have been growing economically, while the United States has been growing through debt and through becoming an increasingly unstable economy. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean the it's an unsustainable debt system that we have right now, and that in you're generating less GDP growth than each dollar of debt that you're adding, so it's clearly unsustainable, and the debt needs, in my view, to be written down to a sustainable level, and the monetary system needs to be reformed. But yeah, the corridor that China announced, what it allows them to do is to create multiple markets whereby gold is traded in yuan, and you can settle yuan for physical gold. So it looks to me like they're setting up a network for a gold-backed global currency. The other thing is that China and Russia several years ago announced that they had a SWIFT bank settlement system alternate that's already been developed and that allows them to trade between their countries without having to go through the Western-controlled SWIFT system.
Right.
And so with the physical settlement from these yuan gold markets that China has announced that they've set up, along with the SWIFT system alternative. And by the way, Saudi Arabia has just contracted an American company to develop a bank settlement system based on blockchain, also outside the SWIFT system. So we can see these various countries are moving to establish a a banking system and a settlement system beyond the reach of Western countries.
Right. David, we're going to have to leave it go at that with just a minute left. In the next 10, 15 seconds, what should investors be doing to prepare for this calamity that lies ahead?
I would consider the fact that it's important to fix interest rates if we're going to have a rising interest rate environment. We have spiking gold prices that happens. And in the end, I think the only secure asset is the metal itself. It's if you hold equities in a banking system discount trading platform, when the banks have problems, oftentimes the traders have problems as well. So it's be a very unstable situation.
All right. We'll have to leave it go at that. So own the metal is what you're saying. Gold, for sure. Silver, maybe secondarily. That is all the time we have. Thanks so much for being with us today, David. Folks, that next week, John Rubino will be with me, Anav Dhaliwal of Bonterra as well, and Michael Oliver, hopefully, too. So until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.